take the opportunity to introduce to you our first speaker here. His name is David Barber. He is a 1998 BYU graduate with a bachelor's degree in philosophy, and he's currently a first-year PhD student in philosophy at the University of Maryland in College Park. He has extensive background and has worked on student review over at BYU, and is here to present a paper on his experiences in a course that he was teaching last year, and the title of his discussion today is Teaching the Historical Jesus.
Good morning. So it's a bit of an informal presentation today. I don't have a paper to read, but the guiding principle behind this talk is never do anything in your life that can't be turned into a Sunstone presentation. Or maybe a bit different, if you do something in your life, turn it into a Sunstone presentation, or at least cocktail conversation. But at this point, it's gone beyond party conversation and is now a Sunstone presentation, so the next level of anecdotal stuff. But there's some philosophy that we'll get to that I think should be fun, and as well as some historical stuff. So the autobiography is I graduated from BYU a couple years ago, and not entirely free of Gene England's influence, and took a year off and worked for Sunstone for a while, and then was accepted to the University of Maryland philosophy program up here in College Park. You take the orange line and then the red line and then the green line. For last fall. And they gave me TA support, so I had to TA a class. And out of the blue, they sent me to this class, a 100-level class. It was called something like, the title was God and Cosmos, and the subtitle was The Quest for the Historical Jesus. And I didn't know then why I'd been assigned. I think now it's because I do have some philosophy of religion background. I've done a thesis in the philosophy of religion and this sort of thing. But it turned out to be a great fit because, unlike most of the philosophy grad students, I've actually read the New Testament and things, and so could field at least those sorts of student questions. The class was taught by a really good professor in our department, Nancy Cater. She's in the department too, out there. And Ray Martin is the professor who taught it, and he wrote this book that came out a year or two ago, called The Elusive Messiah, which is a philosophical overview of the quest for the historical Jesus. And in the book, he goes over a lot of philosophical ground, but a lot of historical ground as well in the current historical Jesus research. So this is what we covered in the class. It was the first time he'd taught the course as a freshman-level class. I guess he had taught it before as sort of a graduate seminar type thing. But here we had 120 students in the class, and was trying to teach these kids about the historical Jesus. Also sort of philosophical issues, philosophy of religion, as well as epistemology that are behind what's going on. So I added heavily to Ray Martin's analysis because I sat through a bunch of his lectures on the subject for what I'm going to say, but we'll go somewhat beyond that. Actually, hopefully. What I want to do today is in three parts, and we may not get to the third one. That's fine. First, I want to just kind of present briefly why historical Jesus research is now a problem rather than, say, 100 years ago or 500 years ago for traditional Christian beliefs. And so in doing that, I'm going to just touch on a few of the results of kind of the current scholarship on the issue. Now, I'm not an expert on historical Jesus research. I don't know Greek. I haven't read the New Testament in Greek. I haven't read most of the books that have been written on the subject. So when you hear me say things, I mean, take it with a grain of salt, but I'll try to be accurate, and I'll give you sources, and you can go look. This is a fascinating literature, and there's a lot of it that's quite accessible that you can go to your bookstore and buy some books and read. The second thing I want to do is talk about three kind of broad strategies that traditional Christianity has for facing up to the challenge posed by these historical findings. And third, but least important, is to situate this, least important for in my goals for this presentation, is to situate this in a sort of philosophical context of try to situate this in an account of the structure of religious belief. This is something that we could talk about for another hour, but I don't really want to, and so we're not going to. And I hope I get to that, and that also sheds some light on my conclusions. But I want to have a bit of time at the end to talk about things. To take questions and answers. And if I lapse into TA mode and start calling on people who haven't been participating, you know, forgive me. So the last 20, 30 years, there's been a revival of research on the historical Jesus. You have at the, you know, earlier on the turn of the century, you know, the great, it's been 3 months, and so I forget his name, but you know that really famous
Boltman
is that's not the one I'm looking for. Well, I mean, Elbert actually knows much more about this sort of... Anyway, so around the turn of the century, you had a lot of historical research, and it kind of died out. But the last little while, there's been a lot, and it's extraordinarily high quality. The scholars working on it are just very, very good scholars. They've found some things... this is a book by E.P. Sanders, who's considered one of the leading... conservative scholars on Jesus, but conservative here not meaning he's defending traditional Christianity. He's conservative meaning just that he's defending a more or less traditional view of the narrative of Jesus' ministry. I don't know what his religious views are, but I kind of doubt that he's... Actually, I'm sure he's not a traditional Christian. Anyway... If you read the Gospels and kind of take overall what they say, then Sanders would back that up with a lot of caveats. He gives a list at the beginning of this book. This is a very accessible book. He's written less accessible books, but this is an accessible book for lay people called The Historical Figure of Jesus by E.P. Sanders. He says there are some things that we know for sure about Jesus. And it's actually a surprisingly long list, given that this guy was a first century CE Jewish peasant. Most historians will agree on the following list. So Jesus was born around 4 BCE, near the time of the death of Herod the Great. He spent his childhood and early adult years in Nazareth, a Galilean village. He was baptized by John the Baptist. It's interesting that almost all the historians, no matter what degree of skepticism they have in approaching the matter, agree that Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, and they have reasons for thinking this. He called disciples. He taught in the towns, villages, and countryside of Galilee, apparently not the cities. He preached the kingdom of God. About the year 30, he went to Jerusalem for Passover. When he said he preached the kingdom of God is in quotes, and a big controversy is what the kingdom of God means, but they agree that he preached the kingdom of God. They also don't know how long. The ministry could have been a few months, or it could have been as long as 3 years. He created a disturbance in the temple area. He had a final meal with his disciples, and he was arrested and interrogated by Jewish authorities, and was executed at the orders of Pontius Pilate. So that's actually a surprisingly long list of things that we can know, but you notice it doesn't include a lot of the things most Christians think are really important, of some sort of spiritual importance. And then Sanders, let me just continue. He has a short list of things that we can say about what happened after Jesus' death. His disciples fled. They saw him after his death. In what sense, it is not certain. As a consequence, they believed that he would return to found the kingdom. They formed a community to await his return and sought to win others to faith in him as God's Messiah. So much for what we can agree about. One of the results that causes maybe the most problems for traditional Christianity is a result that most of the scholars, all the scholars, agree on. It's the untrustworthiness of the sayings of Jesus. Almost all the scholars will tell you that in the Synoptic Gospel accounts, say, between the account of Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist, which they generally agree marks the beginning of the ministry, and then the last week in Jerusalem, you can't trust any sort of chronology. So wandering around the various towns and trying to harmonize those, they say, is absolutely hopeless, and they're not meant to be historical texts, or if they are, they're just not, and there's no way to get them to agree. But also, many, 90% of the sayings, most of the scholars will say, or some enormously high percentage of the sayings they'll say are not authentic with Jesus. Now, they go back to, there are various degrees of earliness of these sayings, and some of them go back to the very early post-Easter community. Some of them go back to Jesus. Some of them are later. But there's and which sayings are authentic and which aren't, that's a matter of tremendous controversy as well. It's interesting that John Meyer, who teaches up the road at Catholic University and is considered just, he's like this great Jesus scholar right now. He's also he's a Catholic, and he's also in the conservative camp. He's even more skeptical about the sayings than many of the revisionist, liberal Jesus scholars. So, for what that's worth, we're doing all right. A couple of things that astonished my students: Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. In fact, the narratives in general are agreed by 80 to 90% of the scholars to be completely fictional. This is something that I had never noticed in Sunday school, in seminary, whatever, like religion class at BYU, that almost none of the details in the two birth narratives in the Gospels match up. The only thing that matches up is that Mary was a virgin when she conceived Jesus. And there aren't necessarily a lot of contradictions in the two accounts. One contradiction is that in one account, and I forget which, in Matthew, Joseph and Mary lived in Bethlehem, apparently. In Luke, they lived in Nazareth, traveled to Bethlehem, and then went back to Nazareth. One has the flight into Egypt, one doesn't. One has the wise men, one doesn't. One has the shepherds, one doesn't. J.D. Croson, who's another bigwig, and he's one of these revisionist liberal guys, again, a top-notch scholar. He wrote this Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, beautifully written book. I highly recommend it. He has this really nice analysis of the two different birth narratives as far as mythological form. I think he says the account in Matthew is... he shows strong parallels with the Moses birth narrative, so representing Jesus as a second Moses type of thing. Anyway, so the birth narratives, I don't know how many Christmases we spoiled last semester, but I know we spoiled a few by pounding this into the kids' heads. Another example is the crucifixion account. There's not as much agreement on this. But Croson, for example, thinks that the whole crucifixion account is entirely fictitious. And one of his main pieces of evidence there, I won't go into it, and I'm not really qualified to go into it deeply, but is that much of the stuff he thinks the disciples just wouldn't have been around to witness or hear about, that really no one would have you know, so we have these detailed minutes of the trial and these sorts of things and the account of the crucifixion. He says that is so unlikely, and he has lots of other reasons, but. Anyway, if you want to go beyond these basics that I read from Sanders, you've got to get into very fine and somewhat speculative historical work. So you can get beyond this fairly full but ultimately boring and unsatisfying list of things that Jesus did, only if you're willing to take some risks. Now, one of the risks that most of the... Well, let's talk about it this way. When you're looking at Jesus, the life of Jesus, at the Gospels, there's a lot of narratives with supernatural stuff in them. Modern historical scholarship doesn't want to look at supernatural stuff. Modern historical scholarship adopts a position known as methodological naturalism, which is, briefly defined, is assuming for the sake of the study that the world is a closed system, or that the universe is a closed system, that there's no divine intervention, no supernatural forces. Nothing happens that can't be explained naturalistically. Now, methodological is important to underline there. It's supposed to be a methodological assumption, not a substantive claim about the way the world is. But scholars make pretty good arguments that if you don't assume methodological naturalism, you're going to end up with methodological chaos. Because why give credence to certain supernatural claims rather than others in studying Jesus or any other historical event? If we don't look for naturalistic causes in telling our historical tales, the range of supernatural causes available to us just is too vast, and the historian's prejudices end up influencing the selection rather than any sort of publicly available method that we can hopefully take to a scholarly conference. This is closely allied, it becomes closely allied with the sort of Humean argument against miracles, which, if you, I mean, take in Philosophy 100, right? Hume has David Hume, a Scottish philosopher, has a very nice argument why one should never believe that a miracle actually occurred, and it has to do with the weights of evidence that you give to a miracle. So, but we'll move on. The situation here is that there's a train wreck. Right, and there's a train coming down the track, and there's another train coming down the same track in the opposite direction. There's traditional Christianity, and I am not going to go into it, but I think we all know it has. And I'm just talking about your basic, you know, Sunday school stories that you hear as a child. The way most people think about Christianity, that Jesus was born of a virgin, he went around doing miracles, he called himself the Son of God, he was then crucified and was resurrected, and that shows that God intervened in history and that Jesus can save us all. That's going along based on some pretty strong historical claims. Then the historians come in, and what makes the new historical work more challenging than previous historical work really is just the level of sophistication that these historians bring to it. So there have been skeptical Jesus historians for the past 200 or 300 years, but now these guys are just so good and work in not just history but cross-cultural anthropology, bring in also whatever disciplines they can apply, they bring in, they also work really hard to keep personal sort of prejudices out of the work. So their findings are fairly robust, but they can be attacked, and we'll get to that. Anyway, we've got this train wreck, and something has to give. And you can sense, this is maybe another, this is an instance maybe, this whole paper is a case study of these culture wars. It has to do with what Gene was talking about, although I missed the first part of his talk. traditional religion is uncomfortable with the findings of modern scholarship. So here's another case of that. And now I'm going to make a fairly vacuous philosophical claim and then try to give some to it. That there are, in fact, three types of ways that current Christian belief can deal with this apparent conflict. Well, let's call it an actual conflict. It's a train wreck. If you take seriously the historical scholarship about Jesus, and if you take seriously the historical claims of traditional Christianity, they don't match up. So, as you can imagine, this is not going to startle anyone. There are three ways to do this. First, you cling to the tradition and the traditional readings of the texts, and you try to ignore the historical scholarship in some way. Second, you exit, walk away, give up on the faith claims and the historical claims that they're tied to. And third, you try to reach some sort of tentative accommodation between the two. So that's a fairly vacuous little structure, but let's see how it goes. Now, I want to talk about this on both an intellectual level and on the level of what I saw with some of my students in the class. A caveat here, most of the students in my class just didn't care. They're freshmen, they're taking this for GE credit, general ed credit, and they just didn't want to do the readings or come to class, and so I don't know what most of my students thought. Second caveat, most of my students weren't traditional Christians, like most Americans. They would, I think on a survey, answer that they believe in God and Jesus and heaven and hell, heaven more than hell. But, in the end, it doesn't make much difference to their lives. And so few of them experienced any sort of real existential conflict, and even fewer of those actually came to talk to me about it. But several of them, I spent hours actually talking with students in my office who had some really interesting things to say. These were the traditional, the hardcore traditional Christians, and some traditional Muslims, which we'll get to. Anyway, so the first option then is to cling to the tradition. There are two ways of doing this. You can do it the lazy way, intellectually lazy way, and just hide your head in the sand. And this is the know-nothing approach that is we see so popular in my favorite whipping boys, the annoying fundamentalist Christian right in the United States today. I don't like those people, and I find the know-nothing approach of this type of thing absurd, and I just don't like it, and if that's my prejudice, and someone can defend it if you want. Or you can actually face up to the intellectuals involved and still maintain the clinging to tradition approach. Now, that's a very difficult thing to do, but some scholars attempt it. Here's another interesting book, again a good read. It's called The Meaning of Jesus. It's written by two Jesus scholars, both pretty big. Marcus Borg is a fairly liberal Christian, but N.T. Wright is a conservative Anglican, I believe, lives in England, and it is the dean of some cathedral or something. He's a respected Jesus scholar. So Tom Wright, in this book, tries to maintain traditional Christian beliefs and to defend the traditional historical claims of Christianity. He argues for the virgin birth. He says that's the most historically plausible explanation of the evidence that we have. He argues for a physical resurrection, and he doesn't do it just by saying that we should believe that Jesus rose from the dead on faith. He says, no, it's the most historically plausible thing to believe. And he has some pretty good reasoning. It's kind of fishy to me that 90% of the scholars working in the field disagree with him. But majority opinion doesn't mean that he's... That majority opinion is against him doesn't mean that he's wrong. And I'm not qualified, actually, to judge these sorts of things. I would have to spend, I think, about 10 years studying Jesus stuff to decide if he's actually right or wrong. But you feel in his writing two things. First, an anxiety, a definite anxiety, at these challenges of modern skeptical scholarship. But second, a real confidence that he's got it right, and that he has kind of eliminated this anxiety. An interesting thing with his standpoint, and the standpoint, again, of good scholars who are working this, he's probably the best Jesus scholar who's trying to defend traditional Christian historical claims. There are other scholars who try to do this, but they're not so good intellectually. But an interesting thing is this gives him a standpoint from which to criticize the background assumptions of secular scholarship, which is a valuable thing to have around, right? So multicultural, whatever. I had one student in my class, we'll call Frank, not his real name, who was a junior. He was a philosophy, just beginning a philosophy major, and a very committed, very conservative Christian. And he took the class so that he could learn to debunk the historical Jesus stuff. But he was really intellectually honest. And this was a personal, you know, encounter that we had with this. So there's an intellectual way, maybe, of getting around, of setting aside the modern results. But this kid, this mattered to his faith. Now, he didn't undergo any sort of existential crisis in the class. I think the psychological structure of personal religious faith is such that he really had no reason to question he had intellectual reasons maybe to question his faith, but no real reason in his life to give up his faith or to call it into question. And so he didn't, really. But we spent hours, one day 8 hours in a stretch in my office talking through these issues. And it's hard to say, you know, who had the upper hand. But I think there's... So what's the point of this? I think there's some thoughtful work to be done, and I think there are thoughtful ways of clinging to the tradition, although it runs into some problems. We'll maybe get to the end of that. There were also some Muslim students in my class, four or five maybe, and one of them was especially bright and came and engaged in the class and came and talked to me for a while. He had... The interesting thing here was, and I don't know a lot about the Muslim religion, but I do know they have an extreme commitment to textual authority, right, of the Quran. And what was the anxiety that I sensed from the Muslim students was that was the strategy of the secular Jesus scholars of reading behind the holy text to get at maybe some reality that's not reflected in the text but might be behind the text. This is the method of all the Jesus scholars. That method, to begin with, calls into question kind of the mainline Islam as it's practiced today. Anyway, we had some nice discussions as well, one Muslim student and I, and the commitment to textual authority in defense of a religion seems to me extraordinarily question-begging. To say, my church is true because the text is true, leaves an obvious question to be asked, but that approach didn't... Now, the one thing that I didn't get as a TA that these students were telling me, that the Muslim students were telling me, they kept insisting, you're trying to divide science and religion. You're trying to divide the secular way of thinking from the religious way of thinking. And I said, yes, I am, because that's how I see the intellectual issues. And this one Muslim student in particular said, in my tradition, we do not divide those things. I didn't see how he could avoid it, and we discussed it. This is an issue for someone, again, who knows more than I. I mean, I saw those that he made, but I didn't see how they were warranted. I didn't think his arguments were good, but I don't think I'm understanding his arguments. The second strategy is to exit. Again, you can do this in a lazy way. This is lots of people do this. Well, I don't know. You can also do it in a rigorous way. What keeps people, individuals, from exiting, of course, is a sort of psychological commitment to their religion. So if you're actually committed to Christianity enough that these historical Jesus problems pose a problem for your belief, then it's going to be a psychological and sociological problem for you to walk away. But intellectually, it's an easy thing to do, I think, is to just give up the fork and allow the skeptical modernism to come in. You can also do this in a rigorous way, though. What do we want to point out about this? From an intellectual standpoint, this amounts to an approach of doing the secular history first and then asking the theological questions later. If you give up the historical ground from the beginning, you can still do theology at the end of the day. I think, you know, Sanders is a paradigmatic approach. He strictly adheres to methodological naturalism and, will give no shrift to any sort of miraculous accounts in the Gospels. He says that if it's a miracle, it's patently made up. I can't consider it. But at the end of the day, he comes up with this interpretation of Jesus, and it's a historical interpretation, and he'll defend it as a historian and not refer to faith claims at all. But he's welcome, I think, to go to church, after the end in the evening, consider the theological implications of what he's found. But that has to be separate on this approach from one's theology, if you're going to do theology at all. So the third and most interesting way is to find some sort of accommodation between the skeptical secular results and the traditional faith-based historical claims. A problem with this, well, let's see. This opens up really creative possibilities, I think. And I'll talk about one of them. The main problem is it can become mushy really quickly, intellectually mushy. And I don't like that. In the context of the course, in discussing faith and reason, Ray Martin gave the students three kind of paradigms. So there's the only faith approach, which is kind of like the first approach I talked about. There's the only reason approach. And then there's faith-seeking understanding. He borrowed that term to mean a sort of accommodation between the two. And so when we asked the final exam question, outline the only faith approach, outline the only reason approach, and outline the faith-seeking understanding approach, which of the three do you think is most intellectually defensible? You know, all the students chose faith-seeking understanding. Oh, yes, it's very nice. Let's all live together and not judge each other. But in the hands of the majority of at least the students who chose this approach, this is an extraordinarily mushy way because you can pretty much justify any sort of claim. Claims don't have purchase against other claims when you're making an argument with this sort of approach. But there are ways to do it in a rigorous way. You end up with some new uses of story and myth, or maybe some revised uses of story and myth, maybe recapturing. The argument's been made that with the Enlightenment emphasis on facts, we've lost the ability to tell stories that have meaning in our lives. There is open to recapture that. You also end up with some new moral understandings, I think, you can in this approach. J.D. Gosen, this is really interesting, I recommend the book that has a much better written account of this. But so in this book, Gosen is talking about healings and exorcisms. Now, it's clear to most scholars that Jesus was known as a healer and especially as an exorcist. Whether he actually healed or exorcised demons is a question that's hard to answer, right? If you assume that no miracles can occur or that we ought not trust accounts of miracles because they're miraculous, then you rule it out. But that's moving from methodological naturalism to a substantive claim that seems unwarranted. How do you know the miracle didn't occur? Well, Croson ends up saying that he doesn't think the miracles occur in what we think of as the traditional sense. But he doesn't stop there. using some really interesting cross-cultural anthropology. He gives this absolutely moving account of these miracles and exorcisms from the point of view of taboo and cultural boundaries. He claims that the power that Jesus had in healing or in casting out demons was not to actually make the physical illness go away, although there may have been psychosomatic or whatever reason to do that, and there may actually have been this miraculous power. He says what's really important is the touch of Jesus, is the violation of the boundaries of taboo that were present in that Jewish society at the time and in most ancient cultures, these body boundaries and these class boundaries. So it's in actually reaching out and touching the leper that Jesus heals the leper, regardless of whether the skin condition persists. And Crichton then goes on and talks about how Jesus did not apparently establish a patronage system, as most healers did at the time, but instead wandered around from town to town, didn't build a power base. It looks like James and Peter wanted him to form a patronage system to settle down. I mean, you have a brother with a gift like this. Well, he's supposed to set up shop and maintain the entire extended family on the gifts that he receives from his healings, right? But now he just wander around touching lepers, violating these taboos. It's to me, a morally moving story. And it's available in the face, in fact, it's quite compatible with these very skeptical findings about Jesus, yet in a way that affirms Christianity in an unexpected way, maybe. Let's move on. So getting back to this very bright and committed Christian student that I had, here's what he wrote on his final exam. When we were talking, Ray Martin ended up advocating a multi-perspectival approach to Jesus' scholarship, where you don't rule out any plausible historical claim, whether it's faith-based or not. Now, one obvious drawback of that is you don't end up with a conclusion. You end up having to keep an open mind about a certain range of possible ways that it actually happened. But this accommodation of faith and reason has a real problem poses a problem for traditional Christianity that I think Frank pointed out quite nicely in his final exam. So let me just read you a couple paragraphs from that. He said, "The problem with the multi-perspectival approach is that one cannot adopt it and at the same time be faithful to Jesus as he is depicted in the New Testament. Christ in the New Testament makes demands of obedience from his followers. One of his commands is to believe in him. If I do not adopt any particular view of who Jesus was, which I must not do if I take the multi-perspectival approach, then how can I believe in him and trust my life to him? The criticism I make against multi-perspectivalism as a Christian is that I must give up my commitment to Scripture. Whether there are adequate grounds for being a Christian is another question, but assuming that there are adequate grounds, the price of adopting a multi-perspectival approach is too high." So it's very nice religiously liberal group here. And as religious liberals, it's fine to say, yes, let's seek some sort of accommodation. But that really doesn't get around the problem that for many types of Christian faith, other sorts of religions' faith, this sort of accommodation is just untenable. It amounts to, it's the same thing as walking away from religion altogether, in a way. So we can argue and say, yes, we should be liberal religious believers and we should accept secular scholarship. We should look at, we should read J. Croson and find moral meanings even though Jesus may not have actually healed lepers. But I don't think it solves the problem for many religious believers, for the people who are really committed to their reading. Now, notice when he says you can't take this approach and be faithful to Jesus as he is depicted in the New Testament. Well, that's Jesus as he is depicted in the New Testament as read by my student's preacher. So, it's not that you can't be a Christian and read J.D. Croson. It's that you can't be this type of Christian and read and accept J.D. Croson. So let me spend 5 minutes then and just situate this in a structure of religious belief, a view that I have and that I can't give you all the arguments for, and then draw some conclusions, and then we'll have a bit of time for questions. I have a feeling that this presentation has been kind of all over the place, but I hope you all, as an intelligent audience, have been able to draw this together a bit. I think when it comes down to it, religious belief, we end up with what I'm going to call, in shorthand, a semi-Kuhnian model of religious belief. Thomas Kuhn, in Structure of Scientific Revolutions, argued that we have these paradigms, right? That science works this way, that we have one paradigm, we look at the world that way, then there's some big anomaly, and we shift to an entirely new paradigm of looking at the world. And a lot of post-war philosophy of religion has gone for some sort of Kuhnian approach. It's clear, I think it's fair to say that Kuhn's wrong, and there are a lot of reasons for that. We can adopt a semi-Kuhnian approach. Let me tell you how it works psychologically and not philosophically. I'll make an empirical claim here, and you can all disagree with me from your own experience. Say you're a religious believer, you pretty much have your worldview set. You go along, you go to the grocery store, you buy things at the checkout counter. The signs on the price register, the cash register, don't mean anything to you religiously. You read the newspaper, you read about protests in Washington, and you don't think much about it religiously. But you're walking along, and you have a certain perhaps feeling in and that you have associated with, say, in the Mormon tradition, the influence of the Holy Ghost. And you do attribute to that event some religious significance. You go to church and you read in your Sunday school class a passage from the New Testament, and you're moved by it, and you attribute some religious significance to that. Most of the time, for most of us, these whatever commitments we have form semi-autonomous spheres of commitment in our lives. There are various ways that we have of dealing with evidence, and they can pretty much coexist. Most of the time, quite comfortably. So a committed Mormon will take a certain feeling as evidence that something is of God. They wouldn't take a certain other feeling as evidence that something is of God, say, speaking in tongues. But a Pentecostal would take that as evidence that something is from God. And we draw these conclusions quite instantaneously. That's how we do it. However, we're committed simultaneously to multiple spheres of use of evidence, to multiple epistemologies in our everyday lives. That's when we're browsing the titles in the National Enquirer about Kathy Lee and Marie Osmond in the checkout line. And we require other standards of evidence when we're at church, and it depends on, right, if the guy who's talking is someone, is an apostle we like or an apostle we don't like, how willing, right? Because we're committed to multiple spheres of, say, epistemological reasoning, there's the possibility of conflict. What we've been talking about today, the historical Jesus research, is one area where this conflict happens for some people. One way of thinking that most of us accept, including the most fundamentalist Christians that you can find, as long as they're educated, is the historical mode of thinking. You read a book about Peter the Great of Russia, you don't argue, you say, oh, well, the author left out the consideration that possibly God intervened in the history of Russia to raise Peter up to the throne and cause him to, found the Russian Navy. We don't see any problem with that. Another sphere or paradigm or whatever is the religious one, and for some people that includes certain historical claim. But because we're committed to these at once, we get this conflict. So some conclusions now. Try to tie this all together. For the modern believer, history is important because of the structure of religious belief. We don't, in modern times, it actually matters if Jesus rose from the dead, because you want your beliefs about religion to also reflect something true about the world. That's true for most people. You can all disagree. For the modern believer, then, history is problematic because of the work on the historical Jesus. The three strategies, let's go over them again. The only faith approach looks unacceptable to me on intellectual grounds. The exiting approach is to give up the fort. Intellectually, it seems okay, but these intellectual standards have a bias built into them, right? And the mixed approach might seem at first to be a constantly shifting ground. This is also something that seems important in the psychology of religious belief to me, that we don't like to constantly be in conflict about our own beliefs. It's your freshman year of college or your whole time at college or certain parts of your life may be heady times because you're in the midst of this intellectual discovery. But you usually like to settle down about your most important commitments intellectually in your life and just get on with living your life. It's a tremendous stress to be holding and constantly testing these various intellectual commitments that you have. And so it seems like a mixed approach, because it's quite difficult to hold on to, might be a constantly shifting ground. However, looking outside Mormonism, there are new equilibria that have been established and that are being established in various other traditions. So in Catholic tradition, in the mainline Protestant traditions, in some of the conservative, evangelical Christian traditions, people are coming to terms in various ways with this stuff and forming some vital and stable ways of accommodating the secular skeptical research and their faith commitments. Both have to give a little bit, I would think. And finally, just to draw a few parallels with Mormonism, or to apply this to Mormonism, Mormonism has the exact same problems with historical Jesus research that the rest of Christianity has, and is not facing up to it at all, obviously, right? This is the idea that I could take a 300-level New Testament class on the Gospels at Brigham Young University, and not hear the word synoptic the phrase synoptic problem, which is how the three synoptic gospels, how one is supposed to correlate them. This boggles the mind. That's the state of things. And as I'm sure you're all several steps ahead of me, but let me just point it out, we have additional problems with historical scriptural stuff. The Book of Mormon historical problems, I think, pose a tremendous challenge that have been addressed by a few people, but ignored by most. Joseph Smith history stuff and the other scriptural commitments of Mormonism pose similar problems. The reason I don't go with a Kuhnian approach, but instead a semi-Kuhnian approach in talking about the structure of religious belief, is because it seems pretty clear that there is a real world out there, and that there are facts somewhere, however hard it is to get at them, and perhaps impossible in some cases. But there look to be facts of the matter about how the Book of Mormon came to us, or how the Doctrine and Covenants was composed, or whatever. I'm not qualified to speak about what those facts are, but it looks like those facts pose big problems for the traditional accounts given in the Mormon Church, and so I'd say, yeah, we need scholarly dialogue about this, religious dialogue about this, and it looks like it's not happening. But on the other hand, to finish off, I can just say in my own life and for various reasons, I've chosen the exit approach, and so I am not going to tell the committed people what to do about this. Each of the three approaches has problems and has advantages, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. Anyway, thanks for your time, and I'll take questions. Okay. So taking the first point, yes, my notion of faith in this paper was nebulous and quite undefined, and I agree that faith includes, at least for most people, and this is an empirical claim that you can all disagree with. Philosophers aren't supposed to make empirical claims, but I make lots of them and try to slip them under the rug. That it includes at least historical commitments, say for most Christians, as well as how one lives one's life type of commitments. And it's not a loss for Christianity to give up the historical commitments or suspend judgment on the historical commitments completely, as long as there is some way then of maintaining this, what most people actually find valuable about Christianity, which is the comfort, the strength, the wisdom that it gives to them in leading their lives. I think sociology of religion actually raises more questions about this, though, because there seems to be some inverse correlation between, the intellectual honesty and the number of energy of the members of a tradition, or at least that's the American experience, right? So the traditions that give the back of the hand to historical research have very committed membership and form these communities that the people find extraordinarily valuable in their lives. The mainline Protestant religions, there's been all the ballyhooing about, so we have these PhDs or well-educated theologians preaching great sermons every Sunday that would get the approval of Ray Martin and most of the University of Maryland philosophy department, but the congregations seem to be dwindling. So there may, I mean, it may be a problem with the way we link, the way in modern American culture we link, or Western culture, I'd say, the charismatic function of Christianity to the historical claims that it makes. We may need to find a different base for the Christian charisma, for the calling to this greater life. Now, the second question, suspending judgment on factual matters, yeah, that's...
Or I think you can question whether it's fact or fact.
Yes, yes.
Or just, sort of, I mean, I'm not familiar with any at all, except for like the idea that there's no such truth. Where you're constantly, you don't come to an endpoint, like,
yeah.
As much as it's a matter of working it out continually. And
yeah.
A certain paradigm truth is one thing, but as the paradigm shifts,
right.
It's no longer applicable. Not to say it was never true, or that it is no longer true, or truth isn't eternal, or that it isn't truth, but that it's contingent.
Yes. I agree. I mean, there are controversial historical issues, and all of this stuff is somewhat questionable because of the assumption, at least, of methodological naturalism that really does bias the results. The problem does arise, though, when you're intellectually committed to using the best history currently available, as well as whatever sort of Christian historical commitments you have. So that may be a good argument, though, against giving up the battle entirely. For the Christians don't choose the exit approach, because there is some degree of uncertainty even in Croson's and Meyer's results. As smart as these guys are, you know, they could well be wrong. So, Gene.
Excuse me. One of the main meanings of faith, at least in the Mormon tradition, is the willingness to consider hypotheses that might otherwise be unavailable to you. And it seems to me one of the real problems with working out some kind of mediation here is the unwillingness, as I understand it, of methodological naturalism to even consider the possibility of miracles or of God revealing things to a writer that he wasn't present to hear. I guess I can't understand the intellectual basis for that. It doesn't seem there's any rational basis for excluding those as possibilities.
Yeah, that's a very good point. The way I would respond as Cherie wants a room. Yes. It's agreed that methodological naturalism is at basis unwarranted. However, it seems just in reading the scholarship, just in dealing with this stuff, that the weight of what's going on, even if you, you know, tends to cut against many of the claims now of traditional Christianity. I'm not saying this very coherently, but and now my brain is really breaking down. But so yes, that's fine. However, I would not, from the criticism of methodological naturalism, I don't think it's warranted to say then anything goes. Okay. So we agree. Last question, no? Okay, great. Thanks.